Hi, everyone, and welcome to Becoming Lincoln. Episode 30, A Sublimity of Impudence. In notes written in February 1857, possibly for use in Chicago elections, Abraham Lincoln reflected on how the Republicans were an alliance of antagonists. He wrote that they, quote, were drawn together by a permanent common danger. Referring to Democrats, Lincoln said that they had faced, quote, a disciplined enemy who had deliberately misconstrued Republican positions. He continued further, quote, and yet, a year ago, they stood up, an army over 1,300,000 strong. That army is, today, the best hope of the nation and of the world. Their work is before them, from which they may not guiltlessly run away. Lincoln and other Republicans were ready for the labor, and they knew it would be difficult. Everyone was expecting a major ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court on slavery. Lincoln, writing in January, said he feared the ruling would stop any attempts to halt the march of slavery. He wrote, quote, so soon as the Supreme Court decides that Dred Scott is a slave, the whole community must decide that not only Dred Scott, but that all persons in like condition are rightfully slaves. Lincoln and many Northerners knew that the Supreme Court, led by a pro-slavery zealot, wanted that outcome. The Dred Scott decision, and its brazen assault on the ideals of the Declaration of Independence, would force Lincoln and many other white Northerners to reconsider their views on the humanity and the citizenship of Black Americans. If the Republican response fell short of what was required, it created a clear contrast with the racist policies of the contemporary Democrats and marked a halting step toward actual democracy. Very little is known about the man at the center of the case. As historian Sean Wilentz wrote, quote, of all the Black Americans who achieved prominence in the fight over slavery, Dred Scott is among the most enigmatic. Neither the white press nor the white officers of the court who decided his fate showed any interest in Scott or his family, save as totems for sectional conflict. We know nothing of their feelings as white jurists raised and dashed their hopes for basic human decency over the course of a decade. But what remains of the Scott family shows that they endured the traumas of slavery and possessed a tenacity that, perhaps, help them through their long legal ordeal. Dred Scott was born sometime around 1800 in Virginia. He appears to have been in his mid to late 50s when the Supreme Court took up his case. When Scott was in his 20s, his owner, a white man named Peter Blow, took Scott and other enslaved men and women to a cotton plantation in Alabama. By 1830, Blow had moved again to St. Louis, where he operated a hotel. Shortly before his death, Blow sold Dred Scott to John Emerson, a U.S. Army surgeon. Dislocations like this almost always involved permanent separation from loved ones. Sidney Blumenthal notes the possibility that Scott may have had a wife and children lost among his owner's many moves. But it's impossible to say for certain. All we know of the first 30 years of Scott's life is where the white men who owned him took him. The Army assigned John Emerson to Fort Armstrong, a base near Rock Island in northern Illinois, from 1833 to 1836. Illinois' Constitution designated it a free state, and some commentators have wondered why Scott did not pursue his freedom there. But remember, Illinois was extremely hostile to Black Americans. And in the 1830s, slavery retained an ambiguous legal standing in the state. There were enslaved people in Illinois, and the state collected taxes on them. It would be another decade before Illinois courts explicitly declared slavery illegal. But if there were uncertainties about the status of slavery in Illinois, there were no such doubts in the Wisconsin Territory, where the U.S. Army transferred Emerson in 1836. As historian Paul Dinkelman notes, 2 weeks before Emerson and Scott arrived, Congress passed the Wisconsin Enabling Act. The law said the 1787 Northwest Ordinance, banning slavery in the Upper Midwest, was in effect in the territory. In addition, Congress said that Wisconsin would follow Michigan's explicitly anti-slavery laws until it could draft its own. The only thing stopping Scott from suing was the isolation of the post, located in what is now Minnesota. While at the fort, Scott met and married Harriet Robinson, an enslaved woman. In a highly unusual move that the family's attorneys would repeatedly cite in the legal battle ahead, Scott and Robinson were married in a civil ceremony conducted by Robinson's owner. Marriage was an implicit recognition of freedom. Slave marriages had no standing in law. Scott and Robinson had 4 children, of whom 2 daughters survived to adulthood. Their oldest daughter, Eliza, was born on a steamboat north of Missouri. As Dinkelman writes, quote, "Eliza Scott was born on a boat in the Mississippi River, surrounded on one side by the free state of Illinois and on the other side by the free territory of Wisconsin." By any legal standard, Eliza Scott was free. But for whatever reason, the Scotts remained with Emerson. He returned to St. Louis in the early 1840s, where he married a widow named Irene Sanford. During this time, Harriet Robinson joined the Second African Baptist Church, pastored by John Anderson. Anderson had worked with the martyred abolitionist Elijah Lovejoy and worked in anti-slavery campaigns in St. Louis, displaying considerable bravery. If the Scots had a case for freedom, Anderson almost certainly informed them of the fact. In fact, historians like Will Lent suggest that Harriet, working with Anderson, had more to do with the lawsuit than Dred Scott. Emerson died suddenly in 1843, and his widow inherited the Scotts. For about 3 years, Irene Sanford Emerson rented Scott and Robinson out to different families. In the late winter of 1846, the Scotts approached Emerson and asked to buy their freedom. Now, legally, the Scotts had a very strong case, and they might have known that they could go to court, win their freedom, and give Irene Emerson nothing. So this may have been an offer or an ultimatum. Conversely, it could have been a way to protect their daughters from being sold further south. Emerson refused to let them go. On April 6, 1846, Dred Scott and Harriet Robinson filed suit. Scott, who could not read or write, signed the legal papers with an X. In Missouri, there had been 11 similar lawsuits filed between 1824 and 1837. Enslaved people won their freedom in all of them. But the Scots encountered a hostile judiciary. A court first dismissed the lawsuit because the Scots had not filed evidence that Irene Emerson owned them. At a trial in 1850, a jury ruled in favor of the Scots. Emerson immediately appealed. Missouri was in the middle of the bitter political war between Senator Thomas Hart Benton, a slaveholder who had come to oppose the expansion of slavery, and David Rice Acheson, a fanatic for imperial human bondage. The Missouri Supreme Court aligned with Acheson. In 1852, the justices ruled against the Scots, throwing away 3 decades of precedent to reach their decision. Chief Justice William Scott, no relation to Dred Scott, wrote, quote, "Times are not now as they were when the former decisions on this subject were made. Since then, not only individuals, but states have been possessed with a dark and fell spirit in relation to slavery, whose gratification is sought in the pursuit of measures whose inevitable consequence must be the overthrow and destruction of our government. Under such circumstances, it does not behoove the state of Missouri to show the least countenance to any measure which might gratify this spirit. The case could have ended with William Scott's breezy nihilism. But shortly after the decision, Irene Emerson transferred title to the Scotts to her brother, John Sanford, a wealthy merchant based in New York. This allowed the family to file suit in federal court on an interstate issue, charging wrongful imprisonment. A federal court agreed to hear the case, an implicit acknowledgement of the Scots' citizenship, but dismissed it in 1854. This led to an appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. The odds did not favor the Scots. As Dinkelman notes, 8 of the 9 justices had been appointed by Democratic presidents. 7 of the justices had been appointed by Southerners. 5 of the justices owned slaves or came from slaveholding families. Chief Justice Roger Taney, whose long gray hair, soft voice, and skeletal appearance made him look like a medieval tomb effigy, privately raged against Republicans and held virulently racist views. As Andrew Jackson's Attorney General in 1832, Taney wrote that any rights black Americans enjoyed were because whites allowed them to do so. He wrote, quote, "They are not looked upon as citizens by the contracting parties who form the Constitution. They were evidently not supposed to be included in the term citizens." The High Court held 2 hearings on the case, one in February 1856 and another that December on matters of jurisdiction. In all, the court heard 4 days of arguments, highly unusual today and unheard of back then. Attorneys for Scott cited the precedents and the actions of the owners that gave the Scots their freedom. Reverend E. Johnson, the attorney representing the Sanfords, argued that without slavery, the Republic would fall. Quote, "The extension of slavery on this continent is the only thing which will preserve the constitutional freedom we now enjoy." At first, the court seemed inclined to issue a limited opinion. As late as February 1857, the majority seemed to be leaning toward affirming its decision in Strader v. Graham, an 1851 ruling that held that states had the absolute right to decide the freedom or servitude of people within their borders. It would have been awful for the Scots, but it would have been limited to them. But Southern politicians, who had delivered 2 presidential contests to the Democrats, wanted more. Men like Georgia's Alexander Stevens, Lincoln's old ally in the House of Representatives, pressed the justices for a sweeping ruling. Then, the president-elect got involved. In early February, James Buchanan wrote Justice John Catron of Tennessee, asking when the decision would come. Catron embodied all the evils of slavery. As a young man, he sexually assaulted an enslaved woman named Sally Thomas, leading to the birth of her son, John. John Thomas, who had become a wealthy businessman, later wrote, quote, "He gave me 25 cents once. If I was correctly informed, that was all he ever did for me." Catron told Buchanan that a decision did not seem likely before the March presidential inauguration. But 2 weeks later, Catron wrote that the court was leaning toward a sweeping decision. He asked Buchanan to push Justice Robert Greer of Pennsylvania to join the Southern majority. In his inauguration address on March 4th, Buchanan spoke of the controversy in Kansas, which he called, quote, "happily, a matter of little practical importance." He went on, quote, "Besides, it is a judicial question, which legitimately belongs to the Supreme Court of the United States, before whom it is now pending, and will, it is understood, be speedily and finally settled." Blumenthal suggests that Buchanan's pressure on Greer, who enthusiastically agreed to join the majority in the case, pushed the court toward a more earth-shaking ruling. Quote, "For all intents and purposes, Buchanan was a co-author of Taney's opinion. Before taking the oath of office as president, he had made himself the 10th Justice." Taney delivered his opinion in a barely audible voice in the Supreme Court chambers in the basement of the U.S. Capitol on March 6, 1857. The Chief Justice first ruled that Scott had no standing to bring his lawsuit. Taney said that Black Americans were not citizens and not entitled to access to the courts. The Chief Justice wrote that Black Americans had, quote, "no rights which the white man was bound to respect." The Chief Justice, referring to the Declaration of Independence, continued, quote, "It is too clear for dispute that the enslaved African race were not intended to be included and formed no part of the people who framed and adopted this declaration. For if the language, as understood in that day, would embrace them, the conduct of the distinguished men who framed the Declaration of Independence would have been utterly and flagrantly inconsistent with the principles they asserted. And instead of the sympathy of mankind to which they so confidently appeared, they would have deserved and received universal rebuke and reprobation." Cruel and vicious though it was, the case should have ended there. But Taney, claiming he had to prevent, quote, "serious mischief and injustice in some future suit," continued, citing no precedents, sweeping through those that contradicted him, and making assertions without evidence. Taney wrote that the Founding Fathers never anticipated acquiring additional territory, and that prohibiting slavery in the territories denied property owners due process. Therefore, Taney ruled, Congress had no power to stop the spread of slavery. Six justices concurred in Taney's ruling. Justice John Campbell of Georgia compared the Missouri Compromise to British oppression prior to the Revolution. Two justices dissented. John McClain, Lincoln's preferred choice for the 1856 Republican presidential nomination, wrote that Taney's denial of citizenship to Black Americans was, quote, "more a matter of taste than law." He noted that citizenship had been granted to the residents of Louisiana, Florida, and the territories acquired from Mexico without reference to race. McClain slammed both the Missouri courts and his colleagues for ignoring the Free State Constitution of Illinois and congressional acts to exclude slavery in denying Scott freedom. He wrote, quote, "If a state court may do this on a question involving the liberty of a human being, what protection do the laws afford?" The somewhat surprising dissent came from Justice Benjamin Curtis, a conservative Whig of the Webster School who had little sympathy for Republicans or abolition. The dissent annihilated Taney's argument. Curtis showed that at least five of the 13 states allowed Black men to vote at the time the Constitution was adopted, and also noted that delegates who drew up the Articles of Confederation refused to include the word white in the document. Curtis wrote, quote, "It is not true, in point of fact, that the Constitution was made exclusively by the white race. And that it was made exclusively by the white race is, in my opinion, not only an assumption not warranted by anything in the Constitution, but contradicted by its opening declaration that it was ordained and established by the people of the United States for themselves and their posterity." Southern newspapers gloated over the Dred Scott decision and insisted the country follow it. The Richmond Inquirer said, quote, "A prize for which the athletes of the nation have often wrestled in the halls of Congress has been awarded at last, by the proper umpire, to those who have justly won it. The nation has achieved a triumph. Sectionalism has been rebuked, and abolitionism has been staggered and stunned." The Washington Union, a mouthpiece for the Buchanan administration, urged the country to submit to the ruling. Quote, "Such an exhibition of the moral conservatism of the people would well correspond with that sublime example of the fitness of the people for self-government lately witnessed in the laying down and taking up of high executive trusts in the midst of orderly enthusiasm." Northerners were so enraged by the decision that William Lloyd Garrison, the abolitionist editor of The Liberator, could run excerpts from mainstream newspapers in his broadsheet without offering additional commentary. A particular point of attack was Taney's narrow and shallow reading of the Declaration of Independence. The New York Tribune wrote, in language that by contemporary standards could have provoked a fight, quote, "This decision, we need hardly say, is entitled to just so much moral weight as would be the judgment of a majority of those congregated in any Washington barroom. It is a dictum prescribed by the stump to the bench, the bowie knife sticking in the stump ready for instant use if needed. This judgment annihilates all compromises and brings us face to face with the great issue in the right shape." Black Americans greeted the decision with moods ranging from resignation to outrage. At the annual meeting of the American Anti-Slavery Society later that year, Robert Purvis, a Philadelphia businessman and adherent of Garrison, introduced a resolution openly mocking abolitionists who suggested the Constitution was an anti-slavery document. Quote, "Here is a country with a sublimity of impudence that knows no parallel, setting itself up before the world as a free country clad of liberty. The land of the free and the home of the brave, the freest country in the world. Gracious God." Purvis went on, quote, "Are we to clank the chains that have been made for us and praise the men who did the deed? Are we to be kicked and scorned, trampled upon, and judicially declared to have no right which white men are bound to respect, and then turn round and glorify and magnify the laws under which all this is done? Are we such base, soulless, spiritless sycophants as all this? Sir, let others do as they may. I never will stultify or disgrace myself by eulogizing a government that tramples me and all that are dear to me in the dust." Taney's decision had many ripple effects. In the short term, it led to a financial panic. When Northerners realized the West might be overrun with slaveholders, they became less interested in settling there. Investment in railroads suddenly froze, leading to a credit crunch and an economic downturn. In the long term, it was a blow to the Supreme Court that took years to recover from. Republicans lost all respect for the tribunal and declared that Taney's ruling on the Missouri Compromise was dicta, or extraneous language meaningless to the case. As president, Lincoln would go still further and ignore Taney's decisions during the Civil War. But the case also forced white Americans to confront the question of black citizenship. Mainstream white opinion suddenly realized that Taney's offensive against black Americans opened the door to attacks on their own freedom. The Chicago Tribune asked, quote, "How much white blood is necessary to make a native-born American a citizen? Will Chief Justice Taney settle the question?" The Zion's Herald and Wesleyan Journal, a Methodist paper published in Boston, said, quote, "There are now no free colored men in the North. Soon they will see that our free labor interferes in some way with their progress, and will begin to interfere with that." The New York Tribune, sharply attacking the Washington Union, said that since a black man was punished in the law the same way as a white man, quote, "he ought therefore to have a voice in prescribing and modifying the penalties of the crime." The Tribune went on, quote, "We rest for the security of our rights, then, not on the fallible and fickle breath of any casual majority, but on the firm basis of eternal justice. And we realize that whatever assails or defies that basis renders all rights unstable, our own included." Several Republican-controlled legislatures in the North, including New York, Ohio, Vermont, and New Hampshire, passed resolutions affirming black citizenship. And it was a question that got injected into the politics of Illinois, a state famous for its anti-black feeling. The Dred Scott decision complicated Stephen Douglas's belief in popular sovereignty. Douglas had argued that the white people of a territory could vote slavery up or down, according to their mood. He cared little about the morality of the question. But in Dred Scott, the court said that there was no way for people to exclude slavery from a territory. As historian Martin Quitt notes, Douglas tried to sidestep this by arguing that the Kansas-Nebraska Act's repeal of the Missouri Compromise simply anticipated the Dred Scott ruling. In a speech in Springfield on June 12, 1857, Douglas said, quote, "It appears that the only sin involved in the passage of the Kansas-Nebraska Act consists in the fact that it removed from the statute book an act of Congress which was unauthorized by the Constitution of the United States and void because it passed without constitutional authority." But Douglas knew this argument could not soothe anger over the law. So he turned to race baiting and the tried and true tactic of conservatives throughout history, sexual panic. Douglas accused Republicans of resisting the decision and said the Founding Fathers, quote, "did not regard the African race as any kind to them." He also suggested that the founders created the federal government to prevent race mixing. Douglas said, quote, "When you confer upon the African race the privileges of citizenship and put them on an equality with white men at the polls, in the jury box, on the bench, in the executive chair, and into the councils of the nation, upon what principle will you deny their equality at the festive board and in the domestic circle?" Lincoln responded to Douglas 2 weeks later in a speech in the Illinois House of Representatives, the only major political address he delivered that year. The speech was not well organized, and most of it was reacting to other issues Douglas raised, like Kansas and Mormons in Utah. But it came to life in its second half during a lengthy discussion of the Dred Scott case and Douglas's criticisms of Republicans. Lincoln said, quote, "We think the Dred Scott case is erroneous. We know the court that made it has often overruled its own devices, and we shall do what we can to have it overrule this. We offer no resistance to it." This was pretty standard for Lincoln. But then he took on the citizenship question. Lincoln had engaged in vicious racism in the 1840 election campaign. His 1852 eulogy for Henry Clay implicitly acknowledged black men and women as part of the human race, but made it clear Lincoln did not consider them members of the American community. But now, using Curtis's dissent as text, Lincoln meditated on the status of black Americans. Without directly referring to Illinois' black codes, Lincoln noted that many states that once allowed black men to vote had long ago rescinded that right and made it much harder to emancipate enslaved men and women. Quote, "Their ultimate destiny has never appeared so hopeless as in the last 3 or 4 years." Lincoln continued, quote, "All the powers of earth seem rapidly combining against him. Mammon is after him, ambition follows, and philosophy follows, and the theology of the day is fast joining the cry. They have him in his prison house. They have searched his person and left no prying instrument with him. One after another, they have closed the heavy iron door upon him, and now they have him, as it were, bolted in with a lock of 100 keys, which can never be unlocked without the concurrence of every key. The keys in the hands of 100 different men, and they scattered to 100 different and distant places. And they stand musing as to what invention, in all the dominions of mind and matter, can be produced to make the impossibility of his escape more complete than it is." This was the first time Lincoln had publicly described slavery as a burden on black Americans rather than an embarrassment for whites. But he went still further in refuting Douglas's insinuations of sexual impropriety. He attacked, quote, "that counterfeit logic which concludes that because I do not want a black woman for a slave, I must necessarily want her for a wife." He continued, quote, "in some respects, she is certainly not my equal, but in her natural right to eat the bread she earns with her own hands without asking leave of anyone else, she is my equal and the equal of all others." To be clear, Lincoln was not a racial egalitarian. He referred to a, quote, "natural disgust about white and black Americans marrying." Lincoln also continued to espouse the foolish idea of colonization, saying it was, quote, "not against our interest to transfer the African to his native clime, and we shall find a way to do it, however great the task may be." None of this would be especially comforting to black Americans in the wake of Dred Scott. But unlike Douglas and the Dred Scott majority, Lincoln emphatically said that black men and women deserved the protection of the law and access to the courts. This was a position radical Republicans had long adopted, and it would soon move to the mainstream. If Lincoln and other Republicans still failed to see black Americans as their full and equal countrymen, Dred Scott had confirmed everything they believed about the slave power and its attack on Republican institutions. Now, they had to draw a line. As Lincoln said, quote, "the Republicans inculcate, with whatever ability they can, that the Negro is a man, that his bondage is cruelly wrong, and that the field of his oppression ought not to be enlarged. The Democrats deny his manhood, deny or dwarf to insignificance the wrong of his bondage, so far as possible, crush all sympathy for him, and cultivate and excite hatred and disgust against him, compliment themselves as Union savers for doing so, and call the indefinite outspreading of his bondage a sacred right of self-government." In this speech, Lincoln made arguments and wrote phrases that he would bring back to his debates with Stephen Douglas in 1858. Those debates would revolve around the humanity and citizenship of the black man, an issue that had been raised by the tenacity of a black family in Missouri. Amid the outrage, the Scott family got some unexpected luck. John Sanford died shortly before the decision was announced, reverting ownership of the family back to Irene Sanford. Irene had married Calvin Chafee, an abolitionist congressman from Massachusetts. Chafee, it was said, had learned that he had become a slaveholder through the newspapers. Chafee transferred title to Scott's old owners, the Blows, who quietly freed the family in May 1857. Dred Scott went to work at a St. Louis hotel, but died of tuberculosis on September 17, 1858. Harriet Robinson lived another 18 years. The New York Times wrote 4 days after Scott's death, quote, "that illustrious personage carried his case to the Supreme Court above, not doubting, we may believe, that the adverse decision he encountered here will be met with reversal, and that he at once will be admitted to a better freedom and more equal citizenship." Next time, we'll come to the eve of the 1858 Senate campaign between Lincoln and Douglas. We'll look at Douglas's split with James Buchanan and Lincoln's efforts to keep the Republicans united behind his candidacy as Douglas flirted with the new party.